Okay, class, we're reconvening here. Any comments or questions before we move ahead? This session is, of course, a continuation of our examination of the secret knowledge by David Mamet. I don't know how you pronounce it. Mammy. And he has an excellent description of how ideologies and mindsets develop and cripple us. Would anyone like to summarize what he says? Anybody? There are a lot of different ways this can be approached, but his way is kind of interesting. And he makes it pretty clear that society rigs its educational institutions so that certain ideologies are promoted over others. Ideologies, theologies, and some of this... all of this is nuanced, it's very subtle behind the scenes, but there is the expectation that you are to think in certain ways. Anybody want to summarize it for me?
Well, it's pro-big government.
Okay.
It's like the opposite of striving for prosperity, even though many people do. Their thought process is that's not a good lifestyle or whatever.
Right, and they. Well, one of the things I think that happens here, he doesn't specifically state this, but it's implied in what he's saying, is that education makes it very clear, our schools make it very clear, that you need them to learn. That all learning comes from the teacher, or the textbooks, or the institution of the school. The important things that you need to know have been digested for you and put in textbooks. I loathe textbooks. I do not intend to have any more textbooks in Walden Grove than the bare minimum possible. A textbook might work for learning arithmetic or geometry or chemistry, but it is disastrous anywhere else. Because, for example, this is the whole genesis of Sophie. I went through school and I read all these wonderful stories that are put in the English anthologies and had no idea that some of these authors wrote wonderful things that were never put into anthologies. And there were authors that I never read in school that I discovered later on, like Ambrose Bierce and Kenneth Merrick and Barry Wilkins Freeman and just all kinds of wonderful, marvelous writers. What's her name? Spofford? Harriet Prescott Spofford. Just incredible treasures. And the author of Richard Hallett, the author of Additions, mm-hmm. Tremendous story. And these are all, I mean, Ben Ames. Ben Ames was one of the great writers and screenwriters of the early 19th century, the first half of the 19th century. He wrote the screenplay for well, the screenplay, the movie Heaven Will Wait was based on his novel Heaven Will Wait. And, but he's not anthologized. He's in Sophie, but these are, and yet somebody in their infinite wisdom or lack thereof has decided to promote Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald. And, I have included one or two F. Scott Fitzgerald stories in Sophie done by Hemingway. But, frankly, those stories mostly leave me flat. We have been brainwashed into thinking that they're great writers, but not compared to the other people who were writing at the time. So education is the first ideology is you can learn only through school. You can't learn on your own. You dare not be homeschooled because a professional is not teaching you. You need a professional in order to be taught. And of course that flies in the face of what Plato said, and that was that teachers are midwives. They help the light of learning come into the awareness of the child, and from that point on, the child can learn on his own. The goal of Walden Grove is to produce students that, as quickly as possible in each case, take over the process of educating themselves. And the school continues to provide structure, but there are no limits from that point on to stand in the way of the child learning. And that might happen at the age of, or in the fifth grade, it might happen in the eighth grade, it may happen in the 12th grade, but that's the goal of Walden Grove, is to help students get to the point where they take over the process of education themselves. And then they're ready to move forward. Okay, so he's saying that ethnic groups, cultural groups, whatever, the community tells children through schooling what they're supposed to believe in, what they're supposed to accept, what they're supposed to reject. And he really comes down hard on the idea that you don't have to work. That work is something for plumbers and tradesmen, not for intellectuals. And so our society has developed a generation of parasites. It's important to recognize, he uses the example of Thomas Jefferson a lot in here. Thomas Jefferson, slave owner, adulterer, fool the lover. He compares the process of creating an ideology with Pavlovian instruction. The rat is rewarded for pulling the right lever, hence fool the lover. Children are rewarded for regurgitating what they've been told to believe. Not rewarded for thinking. Not rewarded for standing up and telling the teacher you're full of crap. Now, Walden Grove needs to be run in a way that the child feels free and comfortable to stand up and say, I challenge what you're saying. Not that you're full of crap, but challenges and says, teacher, sir or ma'am, do you know what you're talking about? That should be rewarded behavior, not punished for insolence. And so anyway, this repeated line that he has, Thomas Jefferson, a slave owner, adulterer, fool of lover. So these people are not taught to discern the truth, but to simply associate Thomas Jefferson with slave owner and adulterer, which may or may not be true, but is irrelevant to his accomplishment. What he doesn't say, he says Thomas Jefferson was an adulterer. Well, we don't really know that. He excuses it on the basis, so was every president, most likely. He's no different. Well, we don't really know for a fact that Thomas Jefferson was an adulterer. And the whole Sally Hemings thing is liberal science based on DNA. All that, and of course, these pseudoscientists come out and say, this proves conclusively that he parented Sally Hemings. But no, it doesn't, or her children. It doesn't mean that at all. It only means that somewhere along the line, 15 generations ago, Sally Hemings had a shared ancestor with Thomas Jefferson. It could have been a child, a son of Thomas Jefferson. It could have been a nephew of Thomas Jefferson. There are many, many opportunities here. All it means is that at some point in the DNA chain, there was an intersection of lineage. Doesn't prove at all that it was Thomas Jefferson. And yet you never heard that mentioned once in any of the stories about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. And they've now made movies about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, all of which is fiction. There's no historical fact at all. There is only historical slander. And of course, that's the most ludicrous of all types of slander because Jefferson's not here to defend himself. That's the way ideologies are formed. You slip in the innuendo, you distort people's thinking, and then you reward them for regurgitating. The reason for doing that is that now the left can reject all of his contributions as in terms of the founding of the country and as a president. Mamet's description suggests that modern education is more focused in building up and supporting false ideas about America and the world than in pursuing truth. Every child growing up receives a prejudiced education from parents, church, and schools, either to the left or to the right. At the moment, public education is saturated with liberal concepts. And this is true about private education as well. Most private schools use the same curriculum. This is a burden the thinking adult must shed after schooling by unlearning substantial amounts of lessons he learned and dutifully regurgitated in school. How much unlearning have you had to do to escape the indoctrination of your youth? What surprises have you discovered about the truths you were taught in school? Anybody? What unlearning have you had to do to escape the indoctrination of your youth?
It's interesting that back in probably mentally, like around 1967, I remember a teacher talking about, not using the word global warming, but talking about the concept. And I clearly remember being told that in 50 years, if we stay on this track, the Earth will not exist. You know, human life will not exist.
Well, let's see, that's 6 years from now. Do you think that's an accurate prophecy?
And I think I was in fourth grade, and I just thought, what in the world? And we were living in, you know, an area with steel mills, and thinking, oh, the pollution and this and that. But that's just one thing, you know. I just remembered it was already starting back then.
Yes.
In the 60s.
Right. Other contributions here. Other insights. True confessions. Yes, Rose?
Well, with my Catholic upbringing, I had to overcome being born in original sin and being told I was not worthy and all that sort of stuff. And, I took it all in. That's what they were telling me, so I believed it. And so my first questioning was the thing about eating fish on Friday.
Right.
And so then I just started reviewing all sorts of things, and mean, I didn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, but, you know, I was no longer the robot.
Okay, good. Other examples of unlearning the ideology of your education? Mamet does a pretty good job, I think, of skewering the idea of future shock and all the predictions of the left that the planet is coming to, the Earth is. See, this is the same thing that's happening today. Scare everybody. The sky is falling, the sky is falling. And in fact, Mamet refers to it as Chicken Little thinking, and that's a phrase I've used. The government's going to default. We're going to lose our credit rating. All kinds of horrible things are going to happen unless those nasty, rascally Republicans give Harry Reid everything he wants. And that's the way things are approached in a rigid ideological society.
Well, we're constantly having to overcome the fear that's just thrown out there all the time. You have to absolutely be vigilant all the time as to what's going through your awareness. There's just so much flowing through that it's easy not to pay attention, or you might think something or recall it and you just let it go, but you just have got to be so vigilant.
Right. And you have to unlearn the lessons that you were taught and forced to regurgitate.
Well, not allow any of that to land on your baseline and set up housekeeping. You've got to keep your baseline clear of all that fear and crap.
Exactly.
Now, he brings up that one of the main reasons for government and schools is to stay at a distance. And, you know, we're talking about our necessary concerns right now. Haven't we all learned? God forbid you would never take money away from education. So that's like a mindset. It's unfortunately public education.
It's
that has been ingrained in us that nobody would ever question that.
Right.
That we don't support education, and teachers are always promised, you know, more money, more this, more that. And it's like, what does any of it mean? We've all bought into it.
And as my maid points out, it has been proven over and over again. Studies have shown there's no correlation at all between how much money teachers make and the success of students. Teaching is an art, and it can't be manufactured. The very structure of this is, in order to be a teacher in the public school system, you go to college, you go through teacher ed, and you become, you're taught how to appear to be a teacher. You're not taught how to interact with children. You're taught how to be a teacher, how to appear to be a teacher. And then you're given your own Pavlovian rewards as you go through rank and you get a master's and a doctor and whatnot. But it's entirely an inbred kind of situation, which tends to discourage people who want to do things, go out into the business world and get things done. The problem, well, let me put it this way. I don't mean this too critically, but it's we all know that the monarchy is a self-defeating system because of inbreeding. You have to be in a royal family in order to become king or queen, and there's only a limited number of choices, so there's a lot of inbreeding. Well, if every teacher is forced to go to certain colleges and learn certain curriculum in order to teach, in order to get their certificate, there's a lot of intellectual inbreeding. And that's what produces rigid ideology. And then when the left discovers that they can take over whole groups of educators and unionize them, then that inbreeding becomes even more ludicrous.
He brings up that the left will not accept the fact that people have a right to fail. So they cannot see that education is failing. They cannot allow that fact
uh-huh.
to be accepted. up on this, it's almost like, you know, you can't fail. They'll make an excuse. They'll find something.
Right. The, one of the things he comments is about victims and victimhood. And, he says on page 26, here it is, if we identify every interaction that's possessing a victim, find the victim, get a pellet, we are training ourselves away from the ability to ask, what are the issues? How do I know? What are the biases of the reporters? How do the issues affect me? What, if any, is my responsibility? So he just described what a thinking person would do. And then he says, the preface says, if we label everything a victim, the person who's being exploited is automatically a victim, then obviously victims are people who cannot think for themselves and are totally dependent on his or her flavor of ideology, either left or right. Only when we make the choice to stop being victims, to stop blaming others, to stop seeing others as enemies, can we begin to think. So I think we need a proverb here. You listening? We need a proverb. I've got one. A victim is a trap, or a victim in a trap is a helpless sap. A thinker in a box learns how it unlocks. I'll repeat that for those of you who didn't get it. A victim in a trap is a helpless sap. A thinker in a box learns how it unlocks.
I think Mamet was really, he was never liberal. He said he failed every test in school and refused to read the
meeting. Yeah.
There was something, there was a seed within him that...
Well, he accepted the shell of liberalism, but realizing he didn't live the lifestyle of a liberal. And so it took a while for him to stop regurgitating and stop demanding help.
That's something I think when you asked, what do I remember of my childhood? And that's it. I believed everything I was told.
Yeah. Well, you were a good Catholic.
Good, good little Catholic.
We used to have the public school kids come in on Wednesday with their catechism lessons. I thought they were from another planet. All I knew was Catholic.
Yeah.
Carl, I was going to say also along that line that, you know, making good grades was, you know, something that was seen as a honorable thing, but it was making good grades for, you know, an education process that wasn't very helpful, in, you know, for what was really truly good thinking. That was not part of the education.
Right. So it becomes a miseducation that has to be unlearned.
Right, well, and if you got, you know, all A's, it's a lot to unlearn.
Absolutely. And it doesn't necessarily reflect your talent or your predict your ability to be successful in life, because even today, many of the successful people in life are people who never completed high school or college.
Exactly. They never learned the term being street smart. Something.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, that was all I was going to say about that, about the term being street smart. You always observe in life that there are some people that just seem to know things like that, and they didn't necessarily go to, maybe they didn't even graduate from high school or such, and yet they seem to be very knowledgeable about things intuitively.
Yeah.
But I wanted to comment about the idea of feminism. Having gone to a private school, that school now, I know I have met many of their recent graduates, and they're fanatical and they're feminism. But when I went to the school many years ago, I had a mistress who stressed the word individual. She said, you can do anything you want to because you're an individual. And it was
because she was including everyone, all sexes, and she never used the word "you're a girl or a woman, so you can do everything." However, that's what the school turned into, mm-hmm. where they thought, "Well, this is a girl's school. We're going to stress everything feminine," and it really did change. Well, but after I left,
mm-hmm.
and it's still that way today.
Right. Well, this I'm sad to say is a common phenomenon in schools. It very much obstructs the educational process.
Carl, I would say something else about unlearning is having an attitude of argumentativeness and really like sort of a negative attitude towards things that seemed to have permeated, if we were reading something like Hemingway that was kind of downtrodden, I just don't remember being uplifted the way we really should have been.
Right. Well, this is in part one of the basic structures of modern education is they teach debate. And debate is not a way to train the mind. Debate pollutes the mind with antagonism. Even though you're supposed to be able to debate either side of the issue objectively, debate puts you into a confrontational mode where you win by humiliating your opponent, not by the strength of your arguments. And it is a course in rhetoric, or an approach of rhetoric, rather than it is a pursuit of the truth. And many of you have heard me say before that debate poisons discussion. Debate makes it almost impossible ever to come to the truth. It emphasizes what divides you rather than what unites you. And so debate needs to be replaced with discussion, with the option and not to try to form a consensus, but to try to understand the larger issues involved. And so on the first Tuesday of every month, we have Thinking Out Loud down here. There are a lot of people who come to it, not that many people come to it, but some people who come to it or at first thought it was a debating society. It's not a debating society. It's an opportunity for people to present ideas on a subject and explore the deeper ramifications of it. And yet we have, in my opinion, poisoned the educational system with this emphasis on debate, emphasis on right versus left, right versus wrong, up versus down, and you're either with the opponent or you're against them. You're either with us or against us. And that creates divisions in the mind of the society which the average person has no way of dealing with. It's a very fundamental problem. The mind has the strength to unite and strengthen, to give great strength, but opinion is emotional, and debate is just I can express my opinion in a way that trumps your expression of your opinion. And it's no more adult than my daddy can whip your daddy. Okay, on page 27, he says, in the free market, success comes only from the ability to supply the needs of others. What a remarkable statement. What a remarkable statement. In the free market, success comes only from the ability to supply the needs of others. If you aren't supplying the needs of others, you don't sell, if you grow corn and you save enough corn for your own consumption and then you sell the rest of it, if nobody wants corn, you don't make any money. You may develop the most clever little widget in the world, but if nobody wants the widget, you don't make any money.
And that's why GM should have gone out of business.
That's exactly why GM should have been allowed to go into bankruptcy and reorganize in the regular way.
Yeah,
because
instead of being bailed out.
Bankruptcy is a fact of life in business. And it's not a sign of failure. It's a sign that there needs to be fresh leadership.
Reorganization.
Reorganization. Protection while you reorganize. But this whole notion of too big to fail is itself a completely vacuous idea. Over on page 28, we have, he introduces the theme of choice. Success in life comes not from the ability to choose between four presented answers, but the rather more difficult and painfully acquired ability to formulate the question. And this is near and dear to my heart because, of course, I teach the importance of asking questions and the need to formulate the real question. As long as you're saying, why am I a victim, you're asking the wrong question. As long as you ask the question, since I'm a Catholic, will I go to heaven? You're asking the wrong question. If you ask, why am I angry all the time? You're asking the wrong question. You need to be asking, what do I lack which makes me angry all the time? What do I lack which makes me think I won't go to heaven? And the real question is always, what do I need? How do I need to grow? How do I need to change in order to improve my life? Being a victim, which the left depends upon, makes everybody a slave or a rat to Pavlov, as Mamet puts it. And in doing learning to, oh, I lost my train of thought, the opposite. In learning to ask the right questions, we are able to attract to us the mental energy that we need. Let's see. He, on page 28, he's talking about formulating questions, which brings up the question then, what is an intelligent question? What is a stupid question? How do you know the difference? Anybody?
Well, part of it is whether I'm asking a question in terms of blaming someone else or something else outside myself, or am I asking a question about internally growing?
Right. Okay. Anybody else?
You mean the question of, like, why me, God?
Well, it could be that fundamental type of question, why me, God? The answer, of course, is why not? But it's more of a in school, as you ask questions, are a lot of, well, for example, we were talking about doubt earlier, and the other day I mentioned this guy that is filled with doubt, saturated with it, and can't grow. If your question is, oh, here's a typical example of a question of the left, of the atheist. If God is benevolent and controls everything, why is there war and misery on earth? Why is there poverty? Why? That's a question, a stupid question. Absolutely ignorant question. Why is it a stupid question? Anybody?
It's based on a false premise that God responsible for all that stuff.
Well, exactly. Who said that God had any interest in intervening, that this may very well be part and parcel to his ultimate plan? And besides which, the perception of misery is entirely a personal thing.
And yet you could explain that to them and they would reject it because, you know, they really don't want an answer.
Well, that's
they don't want to give up that.
That's why it's a stupid question. an intelligent question always, first of all, the first rule of asking intelligent questions is every question, every intelligent question has an answer. If your question has no answer, it's a stupid question. Why aren't there five-legged cows? That's a stupid question. Why do cows give milk? That's a more intelligent question because there's an answer. So, if the atheist had asked, well, if there's a God, how can I interact with this God in such a way as to improve the quality of my life? That would be an intelligent question. It would help the atheist overcome his atheism. But to simply say, why shouldn't I blame God for all the misery in the world, indicates a, as you say, an unwillingness to learn. So an intelligent question always presumes an intelligent answer. Stupid questions don't want the answers, and that's the difference.
Maybe blinded.
Yeah. We know, the thing is, you cannot ask an intelligent question and not receive an answer. You may not recognize the answer, you may not like the answer, but if you ask God for help in some area of your life, that help is going to arrive, and it's going to arrive almost immediately. And we need to come up with that construct. The allegory here of peace is the petitioner is holding onto the hand of the leader and petitioning, and with his other hand, he's connecting with heaven, and he's providing the answer of peace. So that's one of the first regulations of Walnut Grove is that teaching is the art of encouraging children to ask questions and never, ever answering snidely, well, that's a dumb question, or that's a stupid question. Unless, of course, it is. But
then when you try to get them to read...
Right. The first thing to do is to say...
Ask it in a better... Can you ask that in a different way?
Exactly.
Can you explain what you mean a little better, or...
Yeah.
Something like that.
Go back to the drawing board. Go back to the chalkboard. Write that in a way that is a sincere request for guidance and wisdom. And that is a good learning experience. He then comes up with this analogy with the book Lost Horizon. I understand his point. I've read Lost Horizon. I don't know whether you have, but I think he has somewhat missed the point of Lost Horizon. I don't know whether you understand it or not, but what does he call this?
What are you talking about?
In The Lost Horizon, James Hilton, he has a name for the place. No, that's what it's actually called.
Oh.
Can anybody help me with this? It slipped my mind right now. The fictional place where the hero ends up in Lost Horizon.
I don't remember.
Shangri-La.
Shangri-La.
Oh, thank you. Shangri-La. Shangri-La is actually a corruption of Shambhala. And what he was doing, he was spooked into writing a book in which there was this society, utopian society, Shambhala, Shangri-La, representing Shambhala, which brought in the idea of the hierarchy and a location. There actually is a Shambhala, and it does have a location. It's not a physical location, it's an etheric location. And it is the center of power and energy on the planet. So Mame is completely missing the point by emphasizing slavery and serfdom here to make the society work. But nonetheless, if you put it in that, and he calls it a fascist tract, it's not. But I can see where with missing the allegorical component, he would think that. So his point is valid. I like his point even better about the music man. The music man analogy here is a great one, because if you remember the music man, it's Professor Henry Hill, or whatever his name was, coming into River City and announcing a problem. We got troubles right here in River City. That's trouble with a capital T. And you spell it P with a P, P-O-O-L. The kids are playing pool. And he uses that as a gambit to alarm the parents into buying musical instruments. And then his con is he teaches them how to play the trombone, but he doesn't really know how. Mm-hmm. But they rise to the occasion and they create music. All right. The analogy is that, of course, that the left always comes in and says, we got trouble right here in River City. We need an extension of the debt ceiling, and we're all going to go broke. And interest rates will rise. And of course, what they're hiding and obscuring is the bare fact that if they had practiced fiscal responsibility in the first 2.5 years of Obama's regime, they wouldn't need a debt increase. But it's always this manufacture of a problem. We got a problem. We got to solve a problem. Government, this is the dirty little secret. Government not only preys on victimhood, but government also creates problems that don't exist. We have the best healthcare system in the world, and Obama comes in and says, oh, we've got to reform our healthcare system. We've got to governmentalize it. We've got to socialize it, blah, 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 blah. And he had control of both houses, so he was able to ram it through. In spite of the protest of 60% of the nation. And of course, he got told in no uncertain terms in November that we the people didn't like it. But this is what the ideology of the left does. It says, invent problems, and especially invent problems that have their own solution. He talks about Freudianism is a problem with its own solution. In other words, it's not a problem at all. You just talk to your psychiatrist once a week for 3 or 4 years, and then the problem's gone away. There's no treatment at all. So the issue is there really a problem or not? And again, he's suggesting that our schooling being a ideological proving ground, or training ground, is one that has convinced us to look for problems in life, and that government needs problems in order to grow. Now, what is the antithesis of that statement? The obvious statement, antithesis, is we need to understand that when problems are solved, government can shrink. So we need to put the emphasis on solution. The way to shrink government is to solve our problems. I have been ranting and raving for 30 or 40 years that there is no poverty in this country. The dirty little secret is that the U.S. government defines poverty on a curve. And so there's always the 10% bottom earners that rate the label poverty. However, there's no real poverty. This is a country where the people in poverty have a car in the driveway, at least one television set, if not more, wear good clothing. There is no poverty. The other dirty little secret about the left is that they play fast and loose with statistics. And so if they say, the most recent one is, that 37%, this is even appeared on a Cheerios box, 37% of the children in this country are hunger challenged. Now, all that means is that 37% of children live within of a certain economic range, live within a range that if the grocery store where they buy their food happens to be out of lettuce 1 week, they're hunger challenged because they don't have the financial resources to go to a further grocery store and buy lettuce. And if that happens once during the year, they're in the hunger challenge category. That's the way the government defines hunger challenge. Doesn't mean that they ever went without lettuce or any other meal, but they're hunger challenged. And then that figure is used to conflate, we got troubles right here at River City. That's troubles with a capital T. And it's just, as Ma'am A would say, bourgeois. That's meant to sound just like bourgeois, I think. Bourgeois. It doesn't mean that, though. So you have to start understanding that, or the point he's making here is that if we define everything in terms of troubles or diseases that will cure themselves, we are condemning ourselves to a life of ignorance. And finally, I love the fact that he quotes Deepak Chopra, who is not one of my favorite people. Our thinking and our behavior are always in anticipation of a response. It is therefore fear-based. If I hear one more person talk about thinking being fear-based, I'm going to regurgitate all over them. Fear-based thinking is an oxymoron. Fear is an emotion. And it's only the left and stupid thinkers that talk about fear and generate fear and use it to get the effects they want. It is, again, this: we got a problem, we got trouble, we got to solve it, and we got to solve it right now. We can't wait for a reasonable discussion. We've been seeing this song and dance since the 60s, since what Dorothy was describing as future shock and the end of the planet, because we were told that we had to solve the injustices of feminism or injustices of discrimination against women, and we have to solve it now, this week, this year. We can't wait any longer. Women have waited forever and ever and ever. And every special interest group around suddenly caught a hold of that. We got to solve this right now. And, of course, it was a little strange when Black started saying, we got to solve slavery. Whoops, we solved that 110 years ago. You know, down here in Atlanta, we get the spectacle of every election. The only people who run for office in Atlanta anymore are Black, and they still play the race card. I'm more Black than you are. My opponent is a racist. He's a Black, but he's a Black racist. You only hear him talk about Blacks being racist when they're running against each other. Otherwise, Blacks can't possibly be racist. But anyway, anything else on Ma'am A? We will try to wrap up his wonderful book in the next two sessions. But I think it's time to go on and... Yes, there it is. The magic gong. We're doing recitations. And I don't have my order here. Let me go back to the... We'll be still in the Fable Gate here. I didn't import my order sequence. So let's go back here. And, okay, I don't think everybody is with us today, but Mary, you're with us, and Mimi, you're with us, and Nancy and Rose. Bill's missing, so has Donna joined us? Donna was planning to join us late, but she probably got stuck. Okay, so after Rose comes Judy, and after Judy comes Dorothy, and then Betty, and then Louise. So the order is Mary, Mimi, Nancy, Rose, Judy, Dorothy, Betty, Louise. Is that everybody? Have I left them?
Sorry, had this off.
Oh.
Carl?
Yes.
Work.
Oh, okay. So you're there on your own. Okay. So then the order is Mary, Mimi, Nancy, Rose, Dorothy, Betty, Louise. And then repeat. Okay? I'll cue you if there's any difficulty here. We're starting with Kurukshetra, which is on page 100. It actually starts on 101. This is from the Bhagavad Gita. And so we'll go through it in order, stanza by stanza, and then we'll repeat and start the sequence again. So Mary, when you're ready. Duryodhana.
All right, Duryodhana, unhappy soul, a kingdom is his own soul. He defied the chains, but rather his vow to circumstances, and seek to make the most of laws by faith and will ordain the law of laws. Ask virtue to become their weapon, so they may run the whole strong, to help their leader as they. And thus advance creation's
path. The flow, drought is next to land, the water can be found at hand. The brothers send the youngest first to try to find relief from thirst. The collar stepping from the grain holds a shimmering crystal rain. Time can go, a voice speaks clear. You warned my son, do not sit here. Answer me well. You may dream. The collar does not pause to think, but dives headfirst into the rain.
Go ahead.
With just one goal, it's first to play. Dives at once along the shore, leaving the panting kids at four. A second mother follows soon, comes upon the same room. The same voice warns, thirst inspires. Brother dreams, then expires. The third, and then the fourth arrive. Like their kin, do not survive. We can see the last pandemic, coming upon the stricken crew, but since the lamentation dying, may the revolution inspire. Hear the voice, heed my advice, but first your brothers paid the price of death. If you answer well, I'll quench your thirst and lift
their spell. You kiss the revolving round, espies a crane atop a mound. Have I gone mad? This is absurd. Grief struck, I'm speaking to a bird. Not any bird, the crane replied, but one in whom you must confide. What is the road to heavenly bliss? The Pandu answers, truthfulness. How can man find tranquility? Acting ever with nobility. What must he slay to conquer grief? Feelings that lead to unbelief, anger, jealousy, hate, and fear, possessiveness of those held dear.
When is man loved, inquires the crane, when he is able to sustain his stance upon the middle ground, much as you stand upon that mound. The crane laughs then, but what was not done, the artist wonder neath the sun, that people think they will defy death, even though their loved ones die. How does one attain perfection? Not by dogma, but by action. Not by words, but through compassion.
by the good works that you fashion.
It is thorough, answered well, and so I shall resist this now. Cause your brothers to give up or go wisdom for one heaven in their fears. As a sign, the creator is forth the light divine, unveiling Dharma for his own. He is saying, he'll regain your throne, revives his brothers one by one, then slips away, for they be known to come to their senses and revive, delighted that they will survive.
And do sue to have their realm returned, as do. But Duryodhana's greed was so great, he can't allow a Pandu's fate. Allies aligned, acts are enlarged, duty called, and must be discharged. War looms over a solid state. Pandu's and Karu's split by fate.
Each side fades, Krishna. And if this fate is weighed, though I won't fight for either side, happy I am to ride beside and give advice as you engage in the camp and battle to rage. For choose the person who wishes in a mind to lend her muscle to your mind. Good
Dharma has to fly once the wish is on the club. Are you not go then to Krishna's aid? Has it to war his destroyed? The warring sides that greed to me have flourished at once the victory of property drawn by solemn hopes to worship and renew their foes. Oh, sorry plain to be defiled by sparring passions vain and proud.
Good morning,
sun breaks
today. Ashima gallops to the fray and sees his cousins all aligned to wage war against his kind. He hesitates. Would it be so that he must into battle go to slay the craving of his youth? Where's the justice? Where's the truth?
He asked of Krishna by his side, would it not be undignified to slaughter all these friends as foe and bring into the world woe?
Krishna replies, the woe is here. Do not disdain it out of fear. The warrior choosing not to fight betrays his caste. It is not right. Upon this theme, the god expands so that Arjuna understands his role on earth, his part in life. The cure of grief, the balm of strife. At last he halts, the arrows fly. And darken the mid-morning sky. For 18 days the battles waged. For 18 days each side's engaged in killing those they once called friend. Until the war comes to an end. A thrust to Duryodhana's heart leads him to rule a dead man's heart.
Bitterness spent the realm tonight to grant your this will the right to rule all in as one state, one land, one dharma, and one fate.
Take heed, O you who challenge life, and blame it for your share of strife. The woe that kills is yours alone. The seeds you reap are seeds you've sown.
Good. This is, apropos to some of what we've been talking about today, ask virtue to become their guide and so on. That's of course from the Bhagavad Gita. All right, we go on then, and on page 120 is the phoenix. This is from the Greek tradition. Let's do it from the top. Mary, it's your turn.
A form is temporal. It must dissolve into its dust and thus evolve, becoming truer to design and helping earth become divine. One soul comes from all creation, breaks the mold for creation and lives a life that has no death. It is just one non-
not exist. It's just a fable. They exist. But myths are real. When read and right, they feed from darkness into light.
The story of the phoenix shows the lack of what the doubter knows. He confounds truth for what he sees, vain superficialities.
Dorothy?
Sorry, I had my mic on. The phoenix is an eastern bird who views the doubter as absurd. When he grows old, his wings turn gold. His unique saga can unfold.
But once he's lived 500 years, he's weakened limb, deaf in his ears. He cannot soar as he once did, and suffers damage to his late did.
Father Time gets a rest, the aging phoenix builds a nest. He gathers myrrh and cinnamon, the shade of ear beneath the sun.
A top on my knee with a poor palm, the phoenix bids the word salam. His sweet voice starts to sing an ancient hymn to recite. And like the wandering voice, my dearly soul, I've
done my best, I've reached
my goal, and now it's time to start again. So to my
life I'll say onward. He flaps his feathers, fans the fire, which over time consumes his pyre. The phoenix dies, he is no more extinct, on to mythic roar.
But stay, the branches sway aloft, a tiny voice sings low and soft. Salam, salam, I have returned and recreated that which burned.
And thus the phoenix reappears to live again 500 years, without the burdens of the old to keep him in their clutching hold.
Free of his former haunches and pain, aches and pains, one solemn beauty of things, he scoops the ashes from his nest and flies off with them to the west.
He rises with the radiant sun, the god is set, the day is done, and leaves behind the residue of what has been, of what not is.
Good. I think you're all improving quite a bit. The important thing here is you're developing confidence in speaking and giving some emotion to the inflection to the words so that you convey the meaning. You're getting much better, and of course we'll keep doing this. I was pleased that everything worked so well with these two that not knowing how many people would be here, nonetheless these two, we went through the list two times and ended perfectly. So very good. This is of course, I need to make an assignment. We won't meet again until August 9th. We will do Tuesday, August 9th, and Thursday, August 11th, and that will conclude the class. Our assignment for Tuesday, August 9th, in addition to working on the secret knowledge and reading Aristotle, is, I don't think so. I want you to read for the literature. I want you to read on page 130 the longish poem by Robert Browning, "Old Pictures in Florence." And don't. Well, after you read it two or three times, it's only 36 stanzas long. There's some great stuff in here. So if something is over your head, just other than the fact that you should research it and try to figure it out, there are some lovely passages in this. That's in Sophie 23, Old Pictures in Florence. I'm sorry?
I was going to tell Judy if she thought Emerson was there.
Well, Robert Browning is known for... not being the easiest person to read, but that's where poetry is, a focusing of the mind, and this is well, let's put it this way. This is one of DK's favorite poems. Okay, there you go. And then, so that's for Tuesday, and then for Thursday, the other piece of reading, if you want to get ahead of yourself, will be in the same issue, The Cat of the Canebrake by Frederick Stewart Green. The Cat of the Canebrake. It's somewhere between 1 and 160. The Cat of the Canebrake is on page 54 of issue 23. Yeah, the snake. So, there you have it. Before we reconvene for this, we will have the seminar on Making a Quantum Leap on Sunday, August 7th. I hope every one of you will participate in that and encourage lots of other people to participate as well. That's the Quantum Leap of Growth. So, any final comments or questions? Then that's
another great class.
Good. Well, thank you for saying so. I'm sorry? Yes, thank you. Yes, it did. Thank you. And so, good luck with all this, and we'll reconvene on Tuesday the 9th. And see you before then, on the 7th. That's it for today.